the number one thing is it has to taste good. You can have the best branding, you can have the best packaging, the social media strategy, all that kind of stuff. But if it doesn't taste good, it means nothing.
Hi, I'm Serena Smith, your host, and this is Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. My guest today has cooked at multiple Michelin-starred restaurants, Noma in Denmark, Momofuku in Toronto, my personal favorite, Alinea in Chicago.
The most happiest moments for me are always food-based. The curveball here is I never wanted to be a chef. I've been around the best chefs in the world, and a lot of their lives, it doesn't align with how my mind wants with life because of my experience with cancer. So that's actually why I left.
He's also a bodybuilding champion and holds 11 Guinness World Records for his knife skills. And Wallace Wong does not stop there.
Let me live. I promise you I will not waste it. And that's sort of my philosophy for my life since then.
His latest venture, Spatula Foods, is a gourmet meal kit offering delicious food cooked 90% of the way before being flash frozen so you can quickly enjoy high quality food at home.
We beat out like all these incredible companies that smart individuals made, but yet we won. So we ended up winning about $60,000. That's sort of how Spatula came to be.
Wallace reaches nearly 2 million followers across his platforms. And today he's breaking down how to turn pain into passion and successfully raise over $1 million for your business. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'll invoice you after for that amazing introduction.
You're going to invoice me? I'm going to pay you for that?
No, I'm waiting for the invoice. My bad.
This is how you're making it all work. I mean, as evidenced by that bio and this table, like, bro, you are busy.
I am. But in all good ways. In all very, very good ways.
What is driving you?
Ironically, we're going to go right into this. I feel like for me, it's you only live once. So I don't like regretting things. And that's a big part of sort of why I'm able to do all this stuff that maybe that you just mentioned.
Where do you think that relationship with not wanting to regret things comes from?
So for me, what is it? This year is going to be 18 years remission. So I, at a very young age, had a battle with cancer. Right here at my eye. It was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And it was like that thing where I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to live tomorrow. And then I remember I made a promise. I was on my bed when I figured this out. I was like, whether you believe in God, whoever, religion, I was like, hey, I haven't done anything in my life. Let me live. I promise you I will not waste it, right? And that's sort of my philosophy for my life since then. So I'm very much, I'll take opportunities, I'll give things a try. And I use the analogy, it's like if you're into sports, I rather shoot 65 for 100 than 2 for 2. Is kind of my energy. So it's like, I'll always swing and you're going to hit it eventually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is beautiful. I mean, it's something that you hear, especially from cancer survivors. And it gives them a different kind of perspective on life and why they're living it. Do you think in all of your ventures and leadership, that's something that can be taught?
I think, yes, 100%. I think if you're talking about like an entrepreneur or someone who's in top management or something, the difference is like tomorrow you could actually make one wrong move and the company could go bankrupt if you want, right? Or maybe your staff suddenly all decides to leave tomorrow because they've been trying to build up this thing and you haven't been listening to them. And it's sort of sometimes if everybody kind of thinks that what we currently have isn't finite, then you start thinking differently and figuring out, oh, how do you treat your employees different? How do we, you know, maybe improve on this and that? Because comfort, I think a lot of times is what kills a lot of ambition and like goals and being able to set things.
How often are you pushing yourself out of your comfort zone?
One of my most feared words or things that I fear in life is regret, is 1000% regret. Ironically, a story I love to share is like, I spent a lot of my like early 20s. My grandparents raised me. And during like just before the pandemic and 20s, my grandmother was in a nursing home. And so for me, I went in there and I spent most of my days in there. At that time, luckily, I was like kind of like still entrepreneur, kind of working on my own time and everything. So I would come in on like the not regular people time, not the before work and not after work. And I would come in on the odd times and I would see things that I'm just like, wow, like it made you think a lot. And very simply is like the amount of people you walk in, let's say you walk into the corridor, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like several individuals who are just on a wheelchair or on a bed, just watching a screen, and they can't do anything like that until someone comes and brings them away or something like that. So for me, I was like, I wonder if you ask these individuals, right? You talk to them, or sometimes I have talked to some people, and the smallest things would be like, wow, you run so fast, or like you walk so easily. And then like, don't worry about me. You know, you walk ahead, small little things like that. And you're like, wow, don't regret the small things. And that like really, really for me drives a lot of stuff of like my daily, whether it's business, personal, fitness, et cetera. No regrets, no regrets.
An appreciation for the life that you've been given.
100%. You need both. You need both. Once you don't regret, and then you sometimes take time and you're able to like look back and just relax and just kind of think about it, you're like, everything is actually not as bad as it can be, as always. People always go like, Wallace, how are you doing? I'm like, there's so many things in my head, like fires, whatever. And I'm like, you know what? I'm doing good. It can always be worse, but I'm doing good.
Was it your grandparents who first instilled the love of food and cooking in you?
Half. What I mean by half is more of, so I'm first generation Chinese Canadian. My family were all sponsored to Canada from like a really like fast food Chinese spot in a little area in Mississauga. And it was like, so grew up folding iconically the red and white takeout boxes that you put like spring rolls in, or the nuclear red, you know, sweet and sour sauce, that kind of stuff. That's what my family was sponsored over for. And my culture of being Hong Kong, like Cantonese, food was like everything. So we would always eat together, like lunch, dinner, we'd always make things. And I always think like the most happiest moments for me, when I think about them, my memories are always food-based. Mm-hmm. We always ate together. We always lived with like a pretty big family together. I ironically never had my first bedroom until university, because I would always share either with my aunt or a cousin or somebody. Wow. So for us, food was really like a big part of our lives. We might not have been able to go traveling. We might not have been able to, you know, do trips or do things because we had so many people. But dinner would always be something that we'd always do together. So that instilled in me this appreciation and love for food. Mm-hmm. But also, food to me is comfort. Food to me is home. Food to me is safety and
connection.
Exactly.
Sorry, you were on a roll. I was like,
that was a great word to finish that off. It was the perfect, perfect little end of that.
Okay, but also, I mean, we were talking about this before we started rolling. I used to be a restaurant critic and food writer. Working in restaurants like that is really grueling.
Yes.
It's not particularly often that somebody like who grows up in a restaurant like that then goes on to stage in some of the world's best restaurants. Like, how did that trajectory happen for you?
So the curveball here is I never wanted to be a chef. Mm. Like, that was not something I ever wanted to do.
Oh my God, by the way, such a likely story. You know how many chefs say, like, I never wanted to be a chef?
I've got half that's like, all I wanted to do is be a chef.
Yeah.
But on the other side, vice versa, same. And for me, the reason why I never wanted to be a chef was because I saw my family do it. Mm-hmm. And my family was, from day one, made sure I knew that, hey, this stuff is hard. This stuff is hard. They don't pay well, X, Y, Z. Like, even just like thinking about like family outings and stuff, there's always be a couple uncles or cousins that wouldn't be attending because they'd be working. So for me, I never wanted to be a chef. I just was really good at it because of growing up and helping with family to cook dinners and lunch, and knew about ingredients because we went grocery shopping. So long story short, I did a competition in high school as an elective. Like, so I did home ec for an elective. It was either that or nails. So I could be a nail tech today, just letting you know. But I did cooking.
And you would probably be at the absolute top of the nail tech.
I would make fire claws for whoever wanted them, right? But I ended up doing that cooking competition, did really, really well. And then I ended up becoming, I was fourth in Canada for that. And then anyways, I went to business school. Mm-hmm. I went to business school because I didn't know what I wanted to do. At that time, we were 16, 17, right? No one knows what they want to do. But I'm like, everything has to involve business, whatever it is. So I'm gonna go to business school, you know, and also like helps, you know, appease family in terms of going for a higher education. That's something that very much instilled in me. I always said I was thrown in the machine of the cookie cutter of like, I'm supposed to be a doctor, a lawyer, a surgeon, accountant, and school, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I went to business school, but then after my first year, I really missed cooking because during high school, I would practice for that cooking competition, like for any sport, right?
Mm-hmm. And you've grown up doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, I started like watching Food Network way more. I was reading like cookbooks versus like my business books. So I did a little search, and down the road from my university was a college. And they had a culinary program. So after, I think it was econ, after I went to an econ class, I took my bag, went down to the college, and I was like peeking through the doors. And then a teacher comes and goes, "Hey, get the class, you're late." And I'm like, "Oh, ma'am, I'm not a student here." And she's like, "What are you talking about?" So I explained, and she's like, "I've got 5 minutes, let me give you a tour." She gave me a tour, gave me a pamphlet. Next term, I signed up. So then I started my second year of business school and my first year of college, of culinary school. And wow. My first week going into that college, remember that competition I did?
Mm-hmm.
So I walked right in, went, I was like, who is the head chef, right? Who's the head chef here? And his name was Chef Philippe. I remember I went to him. I'm like, hey, chef, my name's Wallace. I know there's this competition that I did in high school. There's a college version of it. I'd love to do it. And then him, very, very French. And he's like, oh, hold on, just relax. Like, calm down. Like, there's an audition, all these kind of things. I'm like, sounds good. Let's do it, right? And then long story short, I ended up making the team, representing this college, ended up going to nationals again. And this time I lost by 0.5. I lost by 0.5 of a point. And I'm actually a judge on that competition now. But where I'm getting with this, I promise I'll answer I'll get to that, is like, I got there and I did this cooking stuff, all right? Competition, mm-hmm. I was doing business and all that kind of stuff at the time. I remember in marketing class, I started a Word doc and it was like, the greatest restaurant of all time. And I started like plotting and writing things about like what I would open. And that competition was also because I wanted to get better and figure out and like have advantages over my competitors. I started searching about these restaurants you're very, very familiar with, you know, the Alinea's, the Noma's, the, you know, the French Laundries at that time, the El Bui's, all these kind of things. And I'm like, I need to learn at these places. So then my last year of university and my last year of college, I ended up, as I mentioned, as I started this, just swing for it, right? Shoot your shot. So I sent cold emails to Alinea because I wanted to. At that moment, I was like, I was still in school. I was like, I've got spring break and then I've got summer break. Spring break, I'll figure which one of these places I want to go and work. So Alinea, took that shot. They gave me an email back in like November. I sent it out in like September. November, they're like, "We'll love to have you." It was master chef, by the way, chef. And then so we figure it out. We're like, okay, I'm going to go in spring break. Then December, Christmas Eve. I will never forget this. It was Christmas Eve. I was with my family. And I had originally in October when Renee came and he was doing a book tour, I couldn't afford going to these book things, right? They're expensive. And like, obviously with someone like Renee at that time, who was best restaurant in the world, best chef in the world, the ticket's like $80 or something like that. I'm like, as a student, I can't afford this. So the cookbook store that was hosting that event, I reached out and I was like, "Hey, I'm a student at university and everything. I'd love to, can I volunteer to help out and all these things?" And then she's like, "Yeah." Her name was Allison Fryer. And she's like, "Yeah, come help volunteer and everything." So I volunteered. And then at the end of it, I was like, "Hey, do you think I can get him to sign my book?" Like, I saved up to buy the book so I can get him to sign it. And then me, the business guy, right? Business school, I printed out my CV. I printed out my resume. I had a whole little cover letter. And then I waited my turn with everybody. And I'm like, "Chef, nice to meet you. My name's Wallace." And he's like, "Oh yeah, you're helping out." I was like, "Yeah." I was like, I got him to sign the book. And then I'm like, "By the way, I also cook too." And I'm like, "I know you're probably not going to bring this back on your flight tomorrow to Copenhagen, but I wanted to at least give you this. And feel free if you want to look. I'd love to work with you. I'd love to work at your restaurant and like learn and everything." And he's like, "Chef, you're right. This is definitely not coming with me. But here's my email. Send it." And then, so that was like around like October. So anyways, going back to December, Christmas Eve, 10, it was 11, 1150, something like that. Just before Christmas. And then an email pops up. And then it's It's just Noma. It's like, we'd love to have you come to Noma and work for us. To stage in the summer. And then where I'm getting with this was that's how I got into these restaurants. How I actually got into them was I was a student who went to college and university at the same time and had OSAP and all that kind of stuff. I couldn't pay to go to these places. Mm-hmm. So because there were two also different programs, when we came down to exam time, I was able to kind of talk with the guidance counselors and they were like, hey, let's figure something out schedule-wise and stuff. And it turned out perfectly where my schedules were completely opposite of each college. So or each institution. So when my guys and everybody in business school were studying, I was off technically for college. But in the most humbling way, I didn't need to study for cooking. Like that for me, like cooking was just fun. I was able to just go for it. So I ended up selling sandwiches out of my dorm.
So it was your first entrepreneurial venture?
It was my first college university entrepreneurial adventure. But I started selling sandwiches out of my dorm. And because I lived right across from campus, I did where it was $5 and $10. And it was cheaper than whatever was on campus. And then then we'd use like Facebook and make a little page and people would come. So I'd have people come and line up from, I lived on the fourth floor at that time. So the hallways was all packed. People would buy sandwiches. And then at the college, I would host fundraising dinners. So then those two things were what paid for me to go to Noma and then go to Alinea.
Okay, I'm seeing the foreshadow now for how Spatula Foods came to be. I'm also seeing that you have, and I mean this as a compliment, like you have a sort of shamelessness about you. Like I think so many people really struggle with a sense of imposter syndrome and a fear of really putting themselves out there.
Of course.
It just feels like you were just like you have just been going for it at every turn.
Like I said, I think we started this conversation where I was like, look, Serena, I just go for it. Like I know how it feels like to not have a tomorrow and I don't want to regret it. So ironically, people always say maybe like, I do so many things. I have all these ventures. I'm like, schedule's all crazy, all these kind of stuff. And I'm like, but you guys have to understand, and I don't expect anybody to understand, it was cancer for me was one of the hardest things I've ever done. Not the treatment. I did 6 months of chemotherapy and radiation, spinal cord stuff. All that stuff was hard. But what was the most hardest part about it was being able to be around people, family, friends, guidance counselors, doctors, nurses, people at a supermarket, whatever it is, because hair is going away. Or at the time before I got my surgery, my face actually looked like the Goonies because the tumor was growing, but we didn't know it was a tumor. It was supposed to be just a regular cyst. So I did 4 months in high school. Now you got to hear me. It's high school, right? Where I went from looking regularly to my face deforming.
Already like such an intensely self-conscious.
It was crazy.
Time.
But all that stuff was still not as hard as realizing that when people were upset, sad, angry, emotional, and kind of lost was because I existed. And that was a big driving force for me to be like, I need to get better. It's because I was like, they're all upset because of me. So I have to get better. I have to make sure, that I'm when they talk to me and stuff, I'm good. I'm good. I'm happy. Everything's great and all that kind of stuff. And that really helped drive and motivate me to beat cancer.
But you were aware of the emotional impact you were having on people.
Oh yeah. Like the more and more you get to hang around people or for me, like constantly in front of people for appointments and like seeing people, very, very few people are actually really great actors, right? Mm-hmm. Authenticity is hard. And a lot of times we all wear our emotions on our biggest organ, our skin, and we can see it. And I am very, very, because of that, I'm very aware of it. So I was like, I got to make sure I do better and like things. So that's where the drive comes from. It's that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to stay on the philosophical direction for a moment, do you ever allow yourself to not be good?
Yeah, of course. I'm not good at a lot of things.
No, I mean like not be okay.
Oh, yes, yes. So for me, for that is, there's moments. There's 100% moments and I let myself be in them, but I don't let myself dwell in them and let them take over. Mm. So it's like, hey, it's like you got, if we were using fitness analogy, you got a 30-second hit session right here. So for 30 seconds, vent it out, be upset, da, da, da. All right, now we go back, right? And I think being able to do that sometimes allows me to very much so balance everything. But if I have to be very, very honest, I try to be more on the glass half full always. And that's my biggest thing. And I think it's a great thing for me that luckily enough, I'm always like looking at the other side of things. Mm-hmm. And if there is something that is negative in my life, I try to remove it like as fast as I can, because going back to it, I'm like, I don't know if I have another tomorrow. The last thing I want to do if I did, like, you know, I'm gone tomorrow or gone in the next hour, the last thing I want to do is, what did I do in the last 30 minutes or before I left? I wouldn't want to be angry or upset or anything like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, on that note, you go to work in some of the best restaurants in the world. And, like, you know, just to give people a sense, for people who aren't like deep in the culinary world like we are, like, I mean, Alinea and Noma, like, this is top of the heap in the entire world. Yeah. Generally, if you're going and you're working there, it's because you were on the path to be a chef at that stature. And yet you left it behind. So what was it in that experience that made you say, I want to do something else, actually?
Yeah. So very easily, the reason why I left was not because of, you know, maybe the stigmas of the industry or everything like that. But at that current moment, I was at sort of the peak. I was working with the best chefs. I'm at the best places. It just happened where it was Thanksgiving. I was opening team with the Momofuku guys, and it was American Thanksgiving, Canadian Thanksgiving, and we're all deciding what to do for Thanksgiving. And I was just asking chefs, we were just chatting. And then some of them like, oh, I'm going on vacation, solo vacation. I haven't talked to my family in ages. Or like, oh, I'm just going to hang out here. I need some rest. And I'm like, I've been around the best chefs in the world. And I realized that a lot of their lives, and more so of looking forward into the future of stuff, I'm like, I don't know if my life would be any different per se of like things. And I was like, it doesn't align with how my vision or my heart and mind wants with life because of my experience with cancer. So that's actually why I left. And
it wasn't the life you wanted.
Yeah, it was more like it didn't align with being able to, you know, spend time with family maybe on a Friday night, right? Or being able to do different things. So that's why I left. But then I ended up becoming, I still wanted to cook. Food, like we talked about, is still such a fundamental part of me. Yeah. So I just wanted to find a different way to showcase food and being a chef.
Okay, so tell me then about Spatula Foods and how it came to be. There's obviously like so many kind of meal kit options on the market. What is the unique value prop of Spatula Foods?
Spatula Foods came to me as an opportunity between friends. So back in university, I was with a friend one of the co-founders, her name's Sheila. We actually went to Chinese school together, and like way, way young and back, right? With Velcro shoes kind of vibes. And
you never know when those relationships are going to come back around.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So we went to Chinese school together. We also went to university together. Like, she went to the university down the road. We still kept in touch and things. And then come pandemic time, her fiance at the time, which is now husband, also our co-founder, Ian, that he was doing his MBA program in Italy. So they were both over in Europe, and in his MBA program, they had this, their final project is this like VC competition, and you have to build the company. So I haven't met Ian yet. And then she was like, hey, I wanted to introduce you to my husband. He's kind of doing this thing. And kind of, he just needs some insight and some thoughts on stuff. And I'm like, cool. So we talk, and he's like, hey, we're over here in Europe, there's this like company called Picard, which, think Apple Store meets M&M meat shops.
Yeah, it's all frozen foods, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And like, they make
in Paris.
Billions.
Yeah.
They make billions. And like, this is the French people buying frozen food and eating it versus regular, like fresh,
right?
What we current.
So you know it has to be high quality.
Exactly, yeah, right? So he's like, do you know anything about this? Like, all this kind of, like, I don't, but we can take a look. He's like, You think Canada can do this? Like, do you think, like, I'd love to bring this over to the state or to North America and like kind of use this for my MBA? So I was like, yeah, let's run it. He's like, yeah. So this is like a real competition with real people. The companies are real. There's actually prize money as well. So it's like, let's want to do it. So I took some time, and that's sort of how Spatula came to be. It was actually started off from a school project. And the crazy part, and sort of where everything starts to like rocket ship, like starts the hockey curve or hockey stick, is that we won the competition. And
the you've got a thing about winning competitions, it seems.
I'm competitive. And so we win this competition, and like we beat out crypto companies. We beat out like wind turbines and like these like IT things and all these incredible companies that smart individuals made, but yet we won. So we ended up winning, it was about $60,000. And then I remember we celebrated, and then we as a team were like, hey, so do we want to just kind of like split the, do we want to go 20-20-20 and then call it a day? And then for me, I was like, 20K is not going to do much for me. It's not life-changing or anything. We have something. I was like, hey, I'm cool if we want to just keep going, right?
And all in?
So, yeah. So we all took the 60 and we started with that. We started with that, and then we just kept going, because that venture competition that was in, they also had real VCs. They had real VCs and stuff, and had people that were like interested in what we were doing, and kind of talks happened. Fast forward, we ended up getting our first fundraise. And then we got $1.5 USD, and that like converts to almost like $2 million Canadian, right? And that sped things up, because we went from when we first started Spatula for that competition, Ian and Sheila were in Europe, so I did all the groundwork over here in pandemic lockdown. So it's like getting baggage samples and like taking photos and sending it back to them, trying recipes, getting someone to cook them and bring it back, and all this kind of stuff. To then, when we all came back, was able to rent a commercial kitchen. We started off with one table and like one shelf. That's usually how commercial kitchens work. And then you keep on renting and adding another table, adding another shelf space, whatever. And we were in that commercial. We went from that little one table to ended up being a section, to then being a full section, to ending up, we right now have a 10,000 square foot facility near the airport, which is where we do now. So that really, really helps things up.
That is some serious growth. Mm-hmm. Also, a $1.5 million investment is no small feat.
Yep,
Can you, we've got a lot of aspiring and fledgling entrepreneurs at different stages of their journeys watching this. Like, what is your advice on successfully pitching and getting investors to buy into your concept?
Of course. So it always starts off with the team, right? For me, Sheila, Ian, we all have our skills, and we all fill a pocket. We know about each person's things, but we let each person do their stuff, right? And because each of us knew our responsibilities so well, that when it comes to funding, when it comes to pitching, purely pitching in general, pitching is like going on a date, kind of, right? It's like going on a date. What is one of the things that's most attractive to people is confidence, right? What I mean by confidence is not about, just telling them who they are and everything, but being able to just put yourself out there, answer questions. And in pitching, especially if you're asking for something from someone, right? The key is, that's the difference, right? You're asking for something from someone.
Oh, I'd argue if you're on a date, you might be asking for something
from
someone too.
Yes, that too. And it's like, whether it's like, companionship or the dinner or whatever it is, but in pitch.
Or $1.5 million.
But the key there is, you want to make them feel safe, and you want to make them feel like they can trust you, mm-hmm. right? So for me, if any of the VCs, anybody, we were also on like Dragon's Den, and it's like any of those individuals asked about food, I can answer it with no problem about how we do this, how we do that, where is that? Sheila, in terms of the marketing, the demographics, and with Ian, in terms of the financials and the operations and sort of the logistics, the three of us were able to answer any question that someone would ask us. And I think that's a big thing, because ultimately, someone needs to trust you enough to give you money. And that's sort of the tip there. It's just, you just not be confident and know your stuff.
Okay, But like you go from first being raised in sort of more like hole in the wall mom and pop restaurants to working at restaurants at the highest level. And then you're trying to build something where you have to scale in a very specific way.
Yeah.
These are like all vastly different worlds. And obviously you seem to care deeply about high quality food. So what was your and is your sourcing process to assure that like people are still getting high quality food?
Course.
When you've grown in this way.
So what's unique about Spatula and what we've kind of wanted to do and tried to do about it is I'm not an engineer, right? But I can tell my family, I'm like, hey, I'm a culinary engineer, if you will, where all these dishes are engineered to a point where they're meant to be perfect on our customers' plates at home, not in our kitchens. Mm-hmm. So going into that scaling, the biggest thing that with restaurants or food in general is that making it for one person, two person, four people can scale kind of linearly. Mm-hmm. But when you go from 4 to 4,000 or 4 to 200 even, it's a different ballgame because your pots are bigger, you know, the time of reduction, the condensation, how long does something freeze, right? The ability to maybe it takes 5 minutes to freeze a tray of vegetables. Right. But now suddenly you have a freezer that has 100 trays. And then now it's like you have 100 trays of hot things coming into a freezer that the freezer temperature drops. Then it's like, oh, it's not 5 minutes anymore. It's more like 50 minutes. Right. Or even an hour or something like that. Then it's like, but within that 50 minutes, those vegetables, for instance, they're still kind of cooking. So how do you mitigate that to go from you wanted it to be perfectly, let's say, numerically 90% there? Right. Mm-hmm. But it's cooking because it's not freezing fast enough. It might be closer to 95 or even 97. And then when the customer is actually making the product, now that instruction is no longer the same because it was meant to be for 90% stuff, not 97. Now it's overcooked. Now you've got a problem on that end. Right. So scaling wise of purely just making the food from one small batch to a bigger batch takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time. And a lot of trial and error, a lot of overcooked things, a lot of undercooked things. What's nice about food is mistakes can be edible. What are they tasty or not? It can be subjective, but they're edible, right? They're edible. If anything, just blitz them up and turn it into a soup. Soup of the day. But the scalability of that is how we went. And sourcing wise was, what's nice about food is the more you buy, you get economies of scale, right? Just like other inventories and supplies. So in that sense, being able to buy more stuff gave us better pricing. Now the only problem is like maybe you might be using suppliers that only have small amounts. Then if you want to get suppliers who have big amounts on a consistent basis that has the same kind of quality, now you have to go to a different supplier. So there also is problems of supply chain management. That's why, that side of, hey, not only do we change the recipe, but suddenly we got to change a supplier who ingredient might not be the same that we had for the recipe. So it's this constant battle of adjusting, which luckily enough, chefs are really good at, right? If an ingredient today, if this tomato is a little too sour, oh, we know that maybe if we reduce the sauce a little bit more, add a little bit of sugar, and now it's back to what's our baseline, and then vice versa.
Is that still going on at a granular level at Spatula Foods?
Yeah. So at the current moment, like it's all the recipes, we've pretty much kind of grandfathered them. They're very, very good. Our customers, they like what they like, and they're able to have. We'll have our like one-off specials and things that keep coming. But most of the times, as long as our ingredients and our checkpoints of QA are, it tastes the same, it looks the same, everything, then it's there. But the QA is constantly happening because unfortunately food is something that changes on, it's alive. It's not paper, it's not a rock. So you have to constantly make QAs.
Do you have any other advice born out of your hard-won lessons in terms of putting a food product like this at a high quality out into the market?
I think a big advice is food is hard because there's an expiry date. Technically, another big reason why we went in the frozen route is in Canada, frozen food does not have an expiry date. But we got to put it just to put for society's perspective of what something is good or not good to eat. Like if something is can't expire forever. People are like, something is a little wrong. But frozen, especially when you do it properly, is great to be able to hold and last and have inventory. Now, what's great about food is you have a large audience that you can always hit. There's always food is something very easy for people to connect with. It's way
people
easier to exactly. Right? We have to eat. It's part of our human DNA. So it's a much more lower risk tolerance to buy, let's say, a bag of frozen food or a bag of chips or whatever it is versus, $1,000 laptop or, a car or something like that. So the key with food, and I always find is even in restaurants, I treat Spatula and any of the food products or ventures that I do. The number one thing is it has to taste good, no matter what. You can have the best branding, you can have the best packaging, the social media strategy, all that kind of stuff. But if it doesn't taste good, it means nothing. It's also same with cooking competitions that I've been on. It might not be the best looking, or it is the best looking, but the winning dish, and you ask any single judge, it's always going to be whose tastes better. Whose do I want to be like, I want another bite of, right? And I think if you do a food product or you own a food product, a company, a restaurant, something like that is, does my product make me want to have another bite? And if it says yes, over and over and over again, you know you're good. If you're like, I don't want my food today, or like, I don't want that today, then you're like, oh, something's off, right?
Rigorous attention to quality. Simple, but not easy.
Yes, exactly. Like food.
Yeah, like food. You had this very unique experience of having two co-founders and also developing this business while they were both on another continent. What did that teach you about working with other people at that level and how to make those relationships work?
Yeah, it's crazy because it's very different once pandemic was done, lockdowns, everything, we're all back here. It kind of switched because for me, then Ian and Sheila, they'd be able to take care of the daily operations and stuff. And then I, at the same time, when Spatula was happening, I also was growing my personal brand, Six Pack Chef, at the same time.
Right. I'm so sorry I called you Wallace. I should have been referring to you as Six Pack Chef, right?
Absolutely not. It's one of those where, like, you know what? If formalities, and yes, sure, but Wallace is perfectly fine.
The formal version of you is Six Pack Chef? Okay, good to know.
Like professionally and things like that, right? But so it was very different because it was at the time where a very entrepreneurial kind of career was going on with a very, very corporate career. And it's very, very different. Entrepreneurial is kind of all over the place, timing and stuff. For corporate life, it's very much, you've got regiment. You've got time, clock in, clock out. You've got meetings. You've got all these different things.
Structure.
And it was pretty different and very, very hard to kind of put them together. But what was nice was having with Ian and Sheila and having them back on land, if you will, kind of was able to switch. They were able to take care of the daily operations. Our current CEO, Tim, he was our CEO first, and then now he's our CEO. He's incredible with taking care of the daily operations as well. So we just kind of shifted weight on things. And then, so vice versa, it's like now I'm able to do a little bit more stuff on Six Pack Chef from the content side that also at that time, and still even to today and all these stuff, is still helps with this stuff. So everything I kind of do in my life always connects. And that's what makes it authentic, if you will. Because it's not coming out of like left field, out of nowhere. It's like, oh, I saw that. I remember you did this. And this is why this led to that. And oh, you're doing this. I understand. It makes sense.
Are there moments where you have been pursuing something professionally and you've had that feeling of, oh, this isn't actually entirely authentic to me, and have moved in another direction?
Yeah, of course. I think like ultimately your gut will always know. I watched a podcast the other day and it was talking about like gut instinct and stuff. It's like when we think of something, there's a memory. And sometimes the memory gets locked somewhere in our guts actually. So that's why it's called a gut instinct. Cause when you don't think of it, when it's like you remember it or you don't think it triggers something, it's right here. So that's why it's there. And it's one of the best tools that an entrepreneur or any person that makes decisions has. It's because literally your body's telling you this, right? It's not an external force in anything. And there are times, there's plenty of times in my career where Maybe I was put in a situation, or I was being offered things, or I had opportunities to do X, Y, or Z. And you think about it, right? And you have to constantly think, and you're like, if you have to think that hard for it, it's probably not the right
probably way. A no.
Yeah, it's probably a no. So there are times where sometimes even you might get into it, right? Because you're like, I'm going to give it a shot. Especially for someone like me, maybe I'll take the opportunity. I'm like, you know what? I'll go in there. And the key is, I think, being able to not also put so much pressure on yourself and that empathy on yourself and be like, hey, look, I gave it a shot. It wasn't right. It's not the end of the world. Pivot, right? I think oftentimes a lot of people, we end up investing a lot of times in things that we're like, I spent 3 years of my life doing this, or, you know, I told everybody that I'm going to be doing this and all that kind of stuff, but it's really not good. And you end up staying in there, right? You end up staying in there and you don't ever get to leave. And you're like, then you start having resentment, and then you're like, oh, my life is not good, X, Y, Z. I always think, and I always say, it's like everything that happens in our lives are because of our own personal choices in the most, like, I guess, stripped down way. Like, we are the author of our story. And it's not like someone forced you to go to this job, or it's not like someone forced me to try to take this opportunity. I was like, you know what? I want to take this opportunity. So if I look at it that way, I'm like, oh, I made that choice to take the opportunity. I can also make the choice to not, to leave it and learn from it and then go. And I think that's a big one, is constantly going to these different opportunities, learning from them, whether it's good or bad. And then those things will help you make better judgment calls for things down the road.
It's interesting because, you know, I think such an important part of entrepreneurship is like this kind of really tactical, practical advice. But what you're speaking to is on the other side of things as well, which is sort of like the art and the philosophy of it as well, and being really in touch with yourself, and also recognizing, like, to your earlier point, like, nobody's thinking about you as much as you think that they are. Mm-hmm. And if you're staying the course for the sake of what somebody else thinks or their disappointment in you, then you're going to be missing the mark.
Of course. It's like, I think even if things are very strategic, even if we've got, you know, AI, tech, these things are like very structured, the companies, the brands, the things that we love in life ultimately involve human beings to consume them. And that is the outlier that changes and causes the whole structured thing to sometimes not be structured. Mm-hmm.
We're messy.
Exactly. We're messy on purpose. We fail on purpose. Why does a video suddenly go viral that took 2 seconds for someone to make versus a video that might took a whole crew, right? Mm-hmm. It's just human nature. We love kind of mayhem and chaos, and because we're meant for it. Like, we're meant to make mistakes and we're meant to learn from it. And naturally, once we learn from it, that's how we survive and we keep going and we keep, you know, evolving in the world.
On the human beings front, you know, it's one thing to get the investment and it's quite another thing to have a successful relationship with your investors.
Yes.
How did you manage those relationships, and has it been successful for you?
Yeah. So of course, like, for, in terms of Spatula, for instance, so Ian is incredible at being able to, because he's from tech, he's from big corporate. So he's always, his whole career has been able to be around and know how to speak and know how to converse with other individuals of that league, if you will, if I use the word league. And the ability of going back to what I said about the relationship and of an investor, of a pitch, of a partnership, communication is key. Hmm. Communication is key. Constantly being able to share things, right? No person, we're using business now, but even in a relationship, no one wants to know secrets or hiding things, right? So the ability for someone to have that trust again is to have that constant communication. So in our first pitches and things like that, my job, my thing was always, hey, let me make sure you fully trust the food that we're making, right? I'll talk to you about the food. We can cook, we'll eat, all this kind of stuff. With Sheila, with Ian, all of us together and all these. And then once we're all good, you don't have to eat with me every day, right? Because as an investor, you're like, I don't need to eat Spatula every day, but I need to know about you know, the numbers. I need to know about, you know, what's going on, maybe the new marketing things and stuff. So the ability for us to constantly have newsletters and constant communication with our investors, where Ian's able to just, if an investor reaches out, send something and just be like, hey, this is what's happening. Or here every month, this is sort of an overview snapshot of how we're doing. And that is the key of just making sure that everyone's on the same page.
Is the advice to err on the side of more visibility?
I would use the exact same thing of, I really say it's like business with partners or with investors, and it's like a relationship. Mm-hmm. Like if I was to ask that same question back to you, Serena, is it better to err and not tell you everything if we were together versus to share everything, right? And that also means, for instance, sharing like, hey, I'm having a bad week, right? I'm having a bad week. I'm not feeling good today. Blah, 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 blah. At least someone, there's empathy that can be built. Mm-hmm. There's also maybe the ability for an investor, someone to give advice, right? And that's the key. Because if you don't share that with your investor, you don't share that with your partner, they think everything's great. So when you tell them something's not great, they're like, why did this happen? And then you're like, kind of maybe don't tell them what happened. And they're still like, I still don't get it. Something's not adding up. And then it becomes this thing, right? And relationships are not built that way.
Okay, so tell me how you were able to parlay Spatula Foods into grocery stores.
Yeah, so of course, Spatula is an e-commerce company. We started off online first. We're an e-com kind of society, but we always love retail. And to your question of like scaling, I was able to also scale my connections in terms of being able to, in my career as a chef, as well as being able to be in, I was used to be a brand ambassador for a supplement company. So I would go to, you know, have relationships with distributors and also sales and store managers. But going into the food side of it is my first two supermarkets, if you will, retailers, they were places that for one of them, I shot Top Chef in there. So I still had that connection there. Second one was when I was a private chef for a family up in Muskoka, there's only one supermarket. And so every day I would be there saying hi. And going back to this, and it's that human nature side of it, I go in and I'd always say hi to everybody, right? Whether it's a store manager or the cashier that always would remind me, hey, Wallace, did you bring your bags today? And then I'd bring my bags because I didn't bring my bags the first time one day. And she's like, you got to bring your reusable bags. So I brought it the next day and she gave me like a sticker, right? And she's like, good job. And I was like, I like that. Okay. We just build that relationship. Mm-hmm. So then when we were thinking about what are some brick and mortar spots that Spatula would provide value for to their customers. And those two places were places that I immediately thought of because I'm like, you know, it matches our demographic in terms of price point, in terms of being able to stick out a bit, in terms of just also matching the supermarket's brand propositions to their customers.
And so you reached out to those contacts and that started the process for you.
You swing for the fence. You shoot your shot.
Relationships are everything.
It's everything. Because with relationships, then you can build everything else. It's much easier when your foot's in the door than to be outside and trying to get into the door.
Sometimes you got to remind people of your humanity.
Bingo.
Okay. We could talk forever and ever because you're fascinating and you do 1,000 things. And one day we'll be making the feature length documentary about you. But to wrap things up, like you have been on Canada's Got Talent. You've made these Guinness World Records. You have these crazy knife skills. You started this company. You worked at Alinea and Noma. What has been most nerve-wracking for you?
This interview. Oh, no.
Oh, God, I hope not.
I think the most nerve-wracking thing is, ironically, when I'm in a room or I've put into a situation where I actually am not authentic and I'm trying to be someone else. So In a room, we've got videographers, we've got cameras and all that stuff. What's nerve-wracking is if you need me to look at this camera right here and then act as someone I'm not, I'd be like, oh no, you know, you would see it. And that's very nerve-wracking. I think whenever I'm on a television show or I'm doing a Guinness World Record or anything that involves me needing to show up, what's nice is that I know that at the end of the day, it's me. And that calms me down a lot. Cause then I'm like, I've already done the work. I've practiced, I've done all that stuff. I just need to now show it off and like execute. But when I'm not confident about something that I'm doing or I don't know anything about it, then it's all these like little signals of like, I need to fake it or I need to pretend I do. And that's usually where mistakes happen.
Authenticity is a secret.
It is.
And get those reps up.
Absolutely.
Wallace, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for watching this episode of Shopify Masters. Drop us a comment below. Let us know what you thought about the episode. Be sure to subscribe to catch all future episodes. I'm Serena Smith, and we'll see you next time.